It's Healthcare Unfiltered, and I'm your host, Shadi Nabhan, a hematologist and a medical oncologist with interest in all aspects of healthcare delivery, treatment, leadership, mentorship, and policy. Today's podcast is about artificial intelligence and the application of artificial intelligence in drug development. Today's podcast, I bring in one of my dear friends and colleagues, Dr. Adam Petrich, who I have known for long time since I was at the University of Chicago and he was at Northwestern University. We collaborate on many studies and many articles, many papers. Adam recently took on a role as chief medical officer at Quant Health, looking at the application of AI on drug development, leading the medical strategy there. And he is joining me today to discuss what he does, but really from a clinician perspective, what does he know about artificial intelligence and its application in drug development? So really excited to have Adam on today's podcast. And I appreciate you folks listening to this podcast, supporting it and being avid listeners on it week on and week out. You can, by the way, watch all of these podcast episodes on my YouTube channel, Shadi Nabhan and Healthcare Unfiltered. You can also suggest topics and guests by tweeting at me at Shadi Nabhan or by following me on Twitter or Instagram, Shadi underscore healthcare unfiltered. You can also check out my website, ShadiNabhan.com. And folks, I know that you love to read. How could you not read? So if you are in the market to read something, my first book came out last year, Toxic Exposure, The True Story Behind the Monsanto Trials and the Search for Justice. Check that out. And if you like what you actually read, don't forget to drop me a review on Amazon and Goodreads. My second book is coming out in the fall of 2024. It's called The Cancer Journey, Understanding Diagnosis, Treatment, Recovery, and Prevention. It is a book about the cancer journey from A to Z, written for patients, families, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, about the cancer journey. What goes from A to Z, and how can we make the journey easier on the unfortunate folks who are diagnosed with cancer? So check that out, and I would appreciate if you let me know after it comes out whether you like the book or not. Also, check out my other podcast, The Hem-Onc Pulse. The Hem-Onc Pulse is a podcast that is dedicated exclusively on hematology topics. And I bring in experts in the field of hematology. We talk about relevant issues. We also cover various conferences and congresses throughout the year, focusing on hematology. It is sponsored by Blood Cancers Today and Mashup Media. So I appreciate if you guys also check out the other podcast, the Hem-Onc Pulse. It's the podcast that allows you to keep your fingers on the pulse of all things hematology. And without further ado, Dr. Adam Petrich on the Healthcare Unfiltered podcast. It's his first time. Here he is, the one and only Dr. Adam Petrich. Adam and I have known each other for years, and this is the first time he has blessed me and all of you by coming on Healthcare Unfiltered. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chaddy. Very nice to be here. It's been great knowing you over the years, and very happy to see the success of Healthcare Unfiltered, not to mention your other ventures.
Hey, being on Healthcare Unfiltered is going to be the, I'm telling you, this is like, it's downhill from here, Adam. That's it. You have arrived.
This is the apex of my career.
So tell us a little about you. You have a very interesting career path that obviously I've watched closely and I've admired a lot. But for those who don't know you, tell us a little about you.
Yeah, sure. I finished my clinical fellowship in 2011. And after that, took an academic job at Northwestern University in Chicago. I was there for about 6 years before being recruited to join AbbVie, also in the greater Chicagoland area. And initially spent a couple years in late stage hematology drug development, then went to early development and sort of broadened my focus both on heme malignancy and solid tumor. From there, made a jump to Daiichi Sankyo, where I was for about 3.5 years. Loved it there, all late stage, solid tumor, antibody drug conjugate focused work, big collaborations, primarily with AstraZeneca. As I was towards the end, also a big collaboration with Merck. Very interesting, widespread, late stage solid tumor development, and very bread and butter oncology. Then I sort of got the itch to do something a little more entrepreneurial, if you will, and had this opportunity with this great Series A startup called Quant Health. And Quant Health is a Tel Aviv-based startup that has built a generative AI platform whose goal is to simulate and predict clinical trial outcomes and to collaborate with the sponsors of clinical trials to essentially improve their odds of technical success and to reduce risk and ultimately reduce what's unfortunately the waste that has come to characterize the pharmaceutical industry. And I don't use that term pejoratively. It's just unfortunate that over 90% of drugs that will go into human trials will ultimately never have any regulatory approval. And if we can even just slightly improve the odds of pharmaceutical sponsors in terms of, their go, no-go decisions, where to fail fast, so to speak, where they might be able to enroll fewer patients, where they might be able to turn a negative pod as a negative study positive. I think the ability to just be more efficient within the pharmaceutical industry would have enormous impact.
Interesting, because you've done this drug development when you were at AbbVie, and you've also done late stage, early stage, and you went to Daiichi Sankyo as well, working on this. So you obviously know a lot about drug development on the manufacturer side. In your prior lives, in your experience when you were at AbbVie, for example, as you working on this, how was your experience? I mean, you came from academia and you went to AbbVie. What were your observations? I guess, what were the things that you noticed, like, oh my gosh, I mean, I can't believe that's what we're doing, because it seems like, you're looking at areas to improve current process. So what is current process?
Yeah, I partly joke with people in my current role at Quant Health that I am not an AI expert. I came to
Oh, I know that about you. No, you're not.
I came to this role not as someone who necessarily knows how to engineer the technical or data solution. I come to this role as someone who learned the hard way what the unmet need is in the pharmaceutical industry. Spent 10 years realizing there just has to be a better way to tap the reams of data that are out there. Because the fact of the matter is, when we go through these very elaborate investment decisions, and just for sake of convention, let's take like a typical phase three investment decision in the world of solid tumor oncology. You're looking at a pharmaceutical manufacturer probably making an investment decision somewhere between $200 and $500 million on a single phase three trial. They certainly spend a lot of time and energy doing that. But at the end of the day, the data and analytics on which those decisions are based is frighteningly small. We look at a set of phase two data, perhaps. Maybe there's a parallel phase three readout. There's certainly dose escalation and a fair amount of other early clinical stage data. You might look at competitor data to help understand, if you're kind of a me too or second in class drug. We assess our certain metrics, like a probability of technical success, in a terribly unscientific way. We look at this data and we assign a certain percentage. We arbitrarily almost say, we think this has a roughly 75% odds of succeeding. And in reality, there's kind of two issues with that. One is, like I said, it's sort of like putting your finger to the wind and making an assessment. Secondly, it's a singular event. So it's either going to succeed or fail. And to assign a probability almost makes it seem like you get multiple chances to do this trial, when in fact, you don't. And I think what we need to do, and what the unmet need is precisely what Quant Health is trying to do. Let's actually approach this in a sophisticated way. Let's imagine a world where we can run that trial many different times under many different circumstances. And that's what Gen AI allows. We basically create an in silico representation of the patients who are going to be in this clinical trial, and we can simulate how they will respond, not just to the control arm, but through Gen AI, we can actually simulate and predict how they will respond to the investigational treatment. And that's where these claims start.
But let's try to dissect this just a little bit. So for example, again, I mean, you've ran phase 1, phase 2 studies. I've done the same. So for the sake of argument, there's, like you said, there's a phase 2 study that shows this drug has a response rate of 80% in this particular disease, duration of response is 10 months, blah, blah, blah. And somehow you decide to take this to a phase 3 study. How much of this is, I mean, usually the phase 3 study, you know, you're deciding the control arm, you're deciding the statistical model, you're deciding the number of patients, inclusion, exclusion criteria. And you put kind of like a threshold and you say, if, you know, based on this study, I have a power to detect, you know how it is, like superiority of whatever, 10%, which will get me regulatory approval. Where is the AI in this particular thing coming in? Like, this is the usual process, right? So tell me, where are you inserting AI?
I'm glad you brought that up, and I'll hone in on the fact that you said in there an 80% response rate. I think it's important to distinguish that. Look, if a drug in phase 2 or an early phase shows absolutely once in a generation outstanding results, Gen AI might not be that helpful. On the other hand, if it shows completely terrible results and the sponsor already knows to kill it, Gen AI, again, isn't going to be particularly helpful. Where I think we need Gen AI is everywhere in between, where the case of a drug relative to historical controls, assuming those controls exist, is a tougher case. You think you have a signal. You don't know yet that you do. And, you know, we don't technically get you to knowing that you do, but we increase the confidence or decrease the confidence. But either way, give you greater certainty in the decision. So to answer your question, where is Gen AI? It's an interesting question. And I'll try to explain essentially kind of what our platform does.
And before you do that, because I'm assuming what you're saying is we're not going to really blow things up. We're saying that this is the current process. Is there a way to improve on the current process X, Y, and Z, right? That's why I asked you where you put Gen AI, because you still have to do the phase 3 study.
Yes.
You still have to do the inclusion. You're not saying I don't need to do it. You're just saying, can I improve the accuracy of you saying, right, okay.
I don't want to get so far down the futuristic sci-fi possibilities that we're saying we're going to skip the phase 3 trial or something like that. We definitely still need to do that. And what we want to do is equip the sponsor to make that decision to do a phase 3 trial or whatever phase trial it is with more confidence. And ultimately, at the end of the day, to give them better odds of succeeding. Maybe what I can do is, you know, is compare and contrast us to kind of more recent analytics that have gone into analytic platforms that have gone into informing the same type of process. I think we all know about this process of synthetic control arms, where, you know, there are a number of different companies out there, and I couldn't begin to give a complete inventory because it seems like there's a large proliferation of those. But they will go out and they will harvest data and they will try to give you an updated and much more expanded idea of how the control arm will perform in a clinical trial. We can do that. We've been asked by certain sponsors, manufacturers to do that, essentially generate or supplement their real world data. But that's not really our business model. Our business model and our goal is to do the hard part, which is to say, how can we better predict how that investigational treatment will do? And perhaps most importantly, how can we predict its benefit or lack thereof relative to the standard of care? So we definitely need that strong underpinning of historical standard of care. And in fact, that's sort of at the base of our data inputs. We have an overwhelmingly large database that consists of electronic health and medical records, claims database, death database. But with some of those, we get approximately 350 million lives covered in the US. So it's almost the whole US population, and have very good penetration as well of, you know, electronic and health records as well. And it's all in a tokenized environment. And that gives us really a very strong database with which to work.
And that data exists from, like you said, 350 million lives. So it basically it's available for purchase, right? I mean, just
correct. People, yeah, we work with vendors and, you know, and pay for that data. But essentially, the important part, a lot of people can make that claim to have large databases. I mean, I think relative to a lot of AI providers, ours is superior in a lot of ways, and we don't have to get into that. But the part, the additional parts of the database that inform the AI platform that your conventional, call it data aggregator, does not use, are where we build out an extensive database of clinical trial knowledge, an extensive database of what we call the knowledge graph, knowing everything about how these drugs interact on their target and within human biology. So even when there's something of a lack of data for a given investigational drug from our real world database, we can use the GenAI platform and everything it knows from this biomedical knowledge graph to essentially predict how these patients will do if and when they were given that new drug. So that's where GenAI starts to, you know, kind of touch on that brave new world in which we're entering, where we're not claiming to have some underlying data to know how exactly how patients did perform in real life with a new drug. We're claiming to be able to have an in silico representation of that patient and to have the model predict how that patient will perform.
I think we can both agree that the there's no prediction that's going to be 100% accurate. It's just not possible. What's an acceptable, you know, when you are at AbbVie, yeah, if somebody is coming to you, I mean, if they tell you I can have 100% accuracy, I think, you know, it's BS. But what's an acceptable thing for a sponsor or a pharmaceutical company in terms of the sensitivity and specificity of a predictive model?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've looked at this in many iterations because I've asked my question that a lot.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, like, for instance, when I was at Daiichi, we looked at this fairly extensively. And it turns out in solid tumor oncology, sponsors get it right, meaning when they go to a phase three trial, they get it right a little more than a flip of a coin. It's about 53 to 56%, if you look historically, of phase three solid tumor oncology trials that read out positive. I think we can agree that's probably not good enough
I agree. I actually thought it would be higher, so I agree with you. Yeah.
Right. Now, I'm not saying that I have to plead ignorance with other therapeutic areas and so forth. So
in cardiology may be different, in rheumatology may be different. But the point is, you know, a little bit more than a flip of a coin is not really good.
Right. We know that, you know, in order to convince ourselves we have any value, and certainly to convince any manufacturer sponsors that we have value as a vendor, we need to validate our predictions relative to actual clinical trial outcomes. And we essentially, we go through many steps of validation, you know, with the data itself, mathematical and logical validation steps, for instance. But those really culminate in us making either retrospective or prospective validations about the top line results of clinical trials when they read out. Now, we generally look at that kind of in two types. One is the binary outcome of success, failure. The other is about quantitatively, how close were we to, for instance, let's use oncology, medians for PFS, OS, or perhaps more importantly, a treatment effect as measured by a hazard ratio. It's hard to know, to get back to your question, what should be our standard? We don't, I'll abstain from making a claim that I know what the standard should be. But what I will say is, where it's relatively easy for us to at least give a rate of our success is on the binary outcome standpoint. And when we look at that consistently, and our database of trials in which we've done this has grown, and it's crossed different therapeutic areas, and it's somewhere in the hundreds, but we're adding to it every day, we are consistently in about the mid 80% range, meaning about 85% of the time at the binary endpoint, we can predict successfully whether a trial will be positive or negative. The reason I hesitate to...
But that's huge. 85% is really huge. I mean, that's...
I think it's really good.
It's good. It's huge. It's very, very good.
But is it good enough? Is it good enough is the question. I don't know, because I also, you know, I think it's in the eye of the beholder. We want to get that as good as possible. And just because we get it right on the right side of positive, negative, also doesn't mean we're necessarily very close in terms of the hazard ratio or the medians or something like that. So what we aim to do is kind of our next level is to try to think through these standards of, you know, how close do you have to be to a hazard ratio, or how close do you have to be to medians to call that good enough? I think that could, you know, that could come in different flavors. And that's why, since it's quite subjective, we don't really, we've never put together a cumulative assessment of that, where we want to say this is whatever and agrees is a good or bad standard to go by.
And I presume some of this may vary based on the disease itself. The
that's right.
Part of the, you know, are we dealing with a autoimmune disease? Are you dealing with a cardiovascular disease?
That's exactly right.
But what you're proposing, what I'm hearing you, is that this is not really oncology specific. You know, we're trying to help,
correct,
you know, in any, you know, in any kind of thing. Whenever you have a predictive model, like let's say you come in and say, I have this predictive model that suggests I could be 85% accurate. Don't you need to validate that? And where do you, how do you do the validation piece? Because there's one element is creating a predictive model, which I appreciate, but then you got to validate it somehow.
Great question. We set up basically a framework with each of our customers at the beginning as to how we're going to approach that validation. And we use different terms, kind of like proof of technology, proof of tech, short for proof of technology, versus like proof of value. And we try to create a vision for the organization. And it almost always starts with some type of pilot project. And so validation really has to be dipping your toe in at the beginning. And let's use examples. Oftentimes, what we do with a sponsor is we try to identify one of their clinical trials and one that either is about to have public disclosure of top line results or recently has had disclosure of top line results. And we say, look, let's, if it's of kind of strategic interest to the sponsor, because that could, you know, in a given therapeutic area where they have a lot of interest or they have other trials that are coming with the same platform or the same molecule. And then what we do essentially is go back and look at our feasibility and we say, look, do we feel that we have appropriate numbers of patients with this? Do we have appropriate enrichment of the biomedical knowledge graph to be able to have confidence in the model? Yeah. We go through some preliminary internal validation steps to come back to the sponsor and say whether we're even comfortable taking on that task. You can imagine if it's something like a very rare disease and a radically new target that they're going after, we're going to have a lot less comfort than if it's rheumatoid arthritis and it's a, you know, it's a well-defined TNF is your target, right? We're going to have a lot more confidence in the robustness of our data inputs and our model performance for that latter situation than the former. So that's the first, that's kind of like the pre-step that we take. We say, look, do we have the appropriate pieces in place to even start down this path? And then assuming we do, we try it out on that first trial, or sometimes it's a small series of trials. Right now, we're in the process with a couple sponsors of that exact validation step, mm-hmm. and saying, okay, we know a readout's coming. We're kind of on the clock to continually iteratively revalidate our model, make sure we're making all the right assumptions about this clinical trial. And that's another key piece too, right? Is you do have to make certain assumptions about the population that will be enrolled. Eligibility criteria allow for quite a bit of latitude in terms of the propensity of that patient population to be, you know, either somewhat sick or conversely to have a favorable prognosis. And you don't necessarily know exactly who that population will look like. So I think it's also important when we model these out to share with the sponsor what assumptions we made about the underlying population so that we can compare and contrast our results to the ones that are ultimately delivered in the real trial.
As you're having these conversations with manufacturers and sponsors, what type of questions do you get back? You go in and say, you know, this is what I could do, this is where I can help. How is, you know, what type of additional inquiries do they have for you? I presume you'll be bombarded by questions, but I'm curious, like the top three questions that you always get.
No, good questions. One of the, probably the most frequent question we get from the sponsor is, what data do you need from us to run your model? And our answer to that is typically the bare minimum we need is a ct.gov identifier so that we know the name of your drug, we know the population, we know the eligibility criteria, and we know things about the sample size, et cetera, where we can basically then start to go back and run our models and start to put some constraints around it too. You know, a randomized trial that's only accruing 200 patients will have a much different sort of critical value to its hazard ratio than one that's accruing 5,000 patients. And so we can also inject certain kind of statistical limits, we know, to what our model produces in terms of whether that's going to be positive or negative. So we can go through several steps, but it's important at a minimum to have that ct.gov identifier. So, yeah. And that's in the public domain, and obviously sponsors never have a problem giving right. that. From there, then we can say, well, that really depends on our level of trust and as to where we want to take this. The model performs better generally the more data we have. It's not always night and day. I mean, you know, a sponsor could share all their data with us before they get to that, you know, actual endpoint we're trying to predict. And if it's a disease that's very well represented or a molecule that's very well represented in our knowledge graph and with our underlying real world data, it might not make that big a difference. But again, if it's one of those ones where it's a rare disease, a radically new target, that sponsored data could make a huge difference.
Yeah.
So we kind of customize that request on a case by case basis. So that's the asked the top three questions. So I just
I have okay. a couple of questions follow up, but keep sure. going about the top three, because there's something very important to ask you, but you actually may answer it in your next two.
All right. I'll at least give you the top two because I know those. I'll have to think about the third. The other question that we get is how do I pitch the value of your tool to my budget holders,
my manager,
whoever that may be, right?
Yeah. Because, the guy who controls the money.
Correct. And that's definitely up there in terms, those are the top two questions. And so one of the projects that we're also involved with is trying to paint a picture about how, and so I spent a while with a spreadsheet going through like an itemized phase three investment decision or a phase three budget and saying, look, if we can help with these certain aspects, you know, the number of patients that you enroll or the time to last subject, last dose, the time to, you know, your time at peak sales, et cetera, you can start to essentially calculate a net present value for this tool. Now, you have to make a lot of assumptions, and the sponsor might have vastly different assumptions, but at least you can provide them a snapshot, and they can go in and they can change any assumption they want, and then they can right. calculate their own net present value for this tool. But usually, if you have any reasonable optimism that it's going to do anything good for you, it pays for itself quite quickly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're talking about oftentimes, you know, blockbuster type assets in big indications. And, you know, they would only need an extra day on the market to pay for our services, right? Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, you just can't tell them that you only need an extra day on the market. Right. That usually doesn't fly.
Right, exactly. What I tell them is we hope to make at least one quarter of difference.
Yeah.
You know, your time on peak sales, but
you know, one thing that is, and probably that's amongst my last questions, but one thing that is, as you look at the efficacy of a particular drug, you know, it's how you define efficacy. Some of the trials looking at survival, progression-free survival, disease-free survival, overall response rate, there are gazillion endpoints. And there you've got surrogate endpoints, right? You know, biomarker-driven endpoints, right. All of these. The model that you are working on or trying to create, is it specific to a particular endpoint? In other words, you need a different model for each particular endpoint, or how does that actually work?
Yeah. As you might imagine, our data is better with certain endpoints than with others. So with hard endpoints like survival, we're going to have more data than we might for something like a patient reported outcome, particularly if it's for a rare disease or for if it's something where for whatever reason, it's not commonly captured in a real world database. Like for instance, one that's done only for a clinical trial, but not for routine clinical care of a patient who's not in a clinical trial. We're not necessarily going to have a huge database of that outcome to be able to validate it. We can supplement our database. So what we can do on a sort of bespoke case by case basis is say, look, if a sponsor really needs that data input, then let's go find a vendor, a healthcare system, whatever it is, and get that data and build it into our model. Or we can think about, are there ways to impute that type of endpoint from existing data or look at some surrogacy for it. So we have creative ways to do it. But again, you know, what we want to do is be honest and realistic with our sponsor clients. And if we feel that it's going to be a big challenge, then we want to flag that right away. We want to say, look, we might not feel comfortable with this, or we could get comfortable with it, but you might need to help us source some additional data or help bear the cost of going out to do that, because we can't guarantee that, you know, we have every endpoint for every disease.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing what AI is doing in that particular realm. Adam, is there anything else I should have asked you about, you know, what you're doing, what your thoughts are about this particular topic, venture, or did I capture all of the points? Sometimes I'm completely off mark.
You know, I listened to this podcast called Invest Like the Best. And
I have to start listening to it then.
Yeah. The host at the end of every show, he asks, what's the kindest thing anyone's ever done for you? And I always thought that's an interesting question to ask, because I think it tells a lot about the person.
Well, my question to you, has anybody ever been kind to you aside from me?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what's interesting is, a lot of people have been mean to me over the years, but I do think that...
Me too.
The world of oncology clinical development has actually been very kind. I have met so many fascinating individuals, and I'm sure you have too, who are just, you know, so sharp, so humorous, so kind. And I could give you a whole laundry list, but I think it's interesting. I look back at myself, and when I finished medical school, you know, I thought I might do something like primary care or maybe radiology, but I really did not have hem-onc as part of it. I sort of fell into that during my internal medicine residency, and I can't express how grateful I am. The number of opportunities that sort of opened up to be in this field at the current time. And I think, you know, right now it's certainly one of the leading sort of therapeutic areas at this interface with AI too. But I've just been lucky in so many ways, but to all those nameless people who have mentored and been kind to me over the years, I would send out a note of gratitude.
No worries, Adam. You're welcome. Well, the one and only Adam Petrich, his first time on Healthcare Unfiltered, and if he plays his cards right, it won't be the last time. And you earned a t-shirt, Adam, so you have to just tell me where to send the Healthcare Unfiltered t-shirt, which you must style and wear and be proud of every single day.
Will do. Thank you so much, Chaddy. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to Healthcare Unfiltered. I appreciate your support. I also want to thank Dr. Adam Petrich for coming on this podcast and supporting the show. Thank you, Adam. I look forward to continuing to see the progress that you are making in the field of healthcare. And don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate it, let your friends and colleagues know about the show, refer everyone to listen to Healthcare Unfiltered. Also, if you want to know about clinical hematology, you've got the Hem-Onc Pulse, the podcast that allows you to keep your fingers on the pulse of all things hematology. Before I let you go, I'm going to leave you with a saying by Ernest Hemingway. When people talk, listen completely. Don't be thinking what you're going to say. Most people never listen. Until next time, take care.